This is The End User, episode 94 for Saturday, May 19th, retroactively self-banned. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I am Wizard Mage Taylor Marr.
I like your title, that's good.
Well, good, but it won't last.
It won't last, no?
Yeah, the Wizards and Mages Union will be very upset at me.
They have a copyright claim right now.
Yeah, no, it's not going to go well for the end user in the digital media zone.
Well, we've got an interesting week of news. It's really bottom heavy, you know? There wasn't a lot of huge stories that broke, but there's a lot of little bits and pieces, and I think it'll be kind of interesting to dig into this stuff, but there was so much gossip this week.
True. And we try to stay away from gossip.
We try to not talk about it.
No, but there's some really fun stuff to talk about. So I'm excited to just dive right in.
So thanks everyone for listening to. No. Just kidding.
They're not gonna get that joke, Chris.
Yeah, not until the end. And they'll be like, "Oh, that's what he meant."
Okay. Well, so we're going to start with Google, and we're going to talk about this thing that they launched called Knowledge Graph. And I read this story, Chris. I read a bunch of stories on Knowledge Graph, but I still don't really understand what it is.
Well, they're trying to aggregate answers, just like Bing advertised against, and just like Wolfram Alpha thinks it is. They're trying to aggregate answers instead of just stupid links.
Ah. You know what site I like that did this? Mahalo.
Mahalo was pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't used that in a long time, though, for whatever reason.
No, I don't think anyone has. Not since Veronica Belmont hosted Mahalo Daily.
But it was around for a long time. It was, like, crowdsourced, and you actually got, like, points or something, right?
Well, no, you didn't get points for using it, but they paid people to put together pages.
Right. But I don't know. By the time you get into all of that crowdsourcing stuff,
it's not crowdsourcing if you pay people.
No, but it's still crowdsourcing. You're still taking a lot of people and taking their collective knowledge and writing it down.
But it's only one person who's in charge of one thing, and you're paying them. I don't think that counts as crowdsourcing, but we're getting away from ourselves, and I still don't understand what Google Knowledge Graph is.
Yeah, so whenever they can find an answer for you, instead of just giving you dumb links, they put an answer off to the side right before the advertisements, right?
Okay, yeah, sure.
So
they used to do this with, like, IP addresses and calculations and guesses on things. Do you know if you Google the height of some celebrity, it will give you a best guess? And they've been doing this for like a year.
Nice. Also, I like the one where you search for recursion. That's my favorite little Google Easter egg.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one. I like the dual barrel roll.
Oh, yeah, barrel roll is good. What if somebody was actually searching for do a barrel roll? That would be kind of irritating.
I think they'll probably just bing it.
Yeah, if you're searching for do a barrel roll, you got to bing it. But no, they're going to aggregate a bunch of content from a bunch of different sources. I mean, what's not to love about that, Taylor?
No, it sounds great. I'm looking forward to seeing it in action. And then maybe I'll understand.
We got to actually get our hands on it before I guess we can pass any judgment. But I think it's interesting that they're trying.
Right. Yeah, and this is not the only new thing that Google launched this week. One thing that we've been playing with since we use Google Docs for our show notes is they've added a bunch of new features in Google Docs. They now have a full screen browser view, so it doesn't make it full computer screen. It just makes it full browser screen where they hide the controls, which is nice if you want to just read something or work uninhibited, as some people like to do. And they've added a research tab. Chris, did you get to try this research tab? I mean, it's a Google search sidebar inside the browser page where you're working on your Google Doc.
Right. So I just pulled it up just now in our Google Doc, and it's a little bit weird. You get a search function there, and that looks like it could be useful. It's just a sidebar on the right-hand side. It has default search suggestions for me, I guess based upon everything that I've done when I'm logged in, and I've got Eurasian Badger in there. So that's good. I'll be searching for that. And there he is.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's very bizarre. I wonder what Google search I did earlier this week prompted the Eurasian badger suggestion.
You know what they need to add that's even more important than a research sidebar? They need to add a bibliography sidebar. I bet college students everywhere would really appreciate
it. Yeah, that's one of the things when you look at Google Docs and Microsoft Office is, well, their citation stuff is non-existent. And Office has a really awesome implementation of citations and how to keep track of them and how to generate bibliographies and that kind of thing.
I consider Microsoft Office example of citation integration to be middling.
Well, who does it better?
Well, it could be done better. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, everything could be done better.
No, not everything.
Almost everything.
Well, okay. Could the browser on Windows 8 RT be done better, Chris?
I kind of hope so. So there's been like an internet freakout about this. Mozilla's making a lot of noise and complaining about not being able to implement a browser in Windows RT. That's the ARM version of Windows, or typically the tablet version of Windows. And, you know, they're bringing up the usual avenues of chatter and asking the European Commission to look into it and stuff like that. But is there really a complaint about browsers on the tablet version of Windows? I mean, it's unreleased, so they have no market share on tablet. The iPad has a browser that cannot be usurped either. So I'm not quite sure why this is an issue. I mean, I guess it's an issue because of the history.
Right. So the EU, as well as many states in the US, famously came down really hard on Microsoft for having Internet Explorer be the default browser on all of their operating systems. And it went so far as to, if you buy a copy of Windows in the European Union, they are required to give you a screen where you choose which browser you want to be your default. And then Microsoft tried to give preference to Internet Explorer in that screen, and then they got sued again.
Yeah, now they have this crazy scheme where it's randomized, and you get stuff like, we could get really random browsers. Like, I forget what is actually in there, but there's weird stuff like Sea Monkey or something like that. And it just makes me shudder that somebody who doesn't know anything about computers turns on their computer for the first time and is confronted with a browser choice.
They're stuck with Ice Weasel.
You get stuck with Rock Melt or something. And, oh, man. I wish, I understand why they did that, but I wish they would have just stuck to Firefox, Opera, Chrome, and Internet Explorer, or something like that. Because
I didn't realize that it got that bad, actually. This only makes me feel worse for Microsoft at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. So I understand why Mozilla is making noise about this, but I also don't understand why it's actually going to be an issue.
Neither do I. And so I think we should just let it go and move on.
Well, last thought here. Here's what I think is going to happen. So they're going to have to allow code that allows Mozilla to put the engine on Metro, but they will not have to allow them onto the legacy desktop of Windows 8.
I didn't understand any of that, but I still want to move on.
Okay, let's go.
All right, so turning on our afterburners, moving full steam ahead, 802.11ac, the gigabit Wi-Fi that we've talked about before, you can finally buy it. You can buy a router. It won't work with your computer because you don't have 802.11ac in your computer yet, but you can buy the router if you really, really want to.
But you'll be super cool when somebody does actually have a chipset that works and they bring their computer over to your house.
Yeah, that would be incredibly fortuitous for that person.
So Windows 8 is getting an update to the mail, calendar, people, and the general app previews that they had in the consumer preview when the release candidate gets released. Sorry, the release preview, that is.
So yeah, some nice new apps, just like Apple did. They released messages and some other apps for Lion before they released Mountain Lion. But when Windows 8 does come out, it's going to cost $15 to upgrade from the standard Windows 8 package to the Windows 8 Pro PC package.
Yeah, so that's not so bad. I thought it was going to be more in line with like $30, but at least as an initial promotion, it's going to be $15. So this is a bit of a rumor, but we'll see how it shakes out.
Right, so that's pretty good. Not so good is Parian, the System Preferences tool for Macs, which has for the past 6 years allowed you to view any codec natively in QuickTime, is going to lose its development team within the next couple of months. So it'll still be available, but the worst part is they are not going to be able to guarantee any support for Mountain Lion.
And Netflix has launched a new UI on their website, and it upsets me a little bit because it doesn't work with the keyboard, which means it doesn't work with a remote, which means I don't get to use it on my home theater PC. But maybe that's stretching it. I think the new player and the new interface for the live streaming is actually pretty good.
So you're saying you have to use the mouse?
Yes.
That seems like an oversight. I bet they'll correct that soon. And I wonder if this is kind of the future for viewing video on computers, and maybe Parian won't be so necessary anymore.
Could be. And I don't think they use Silverlight, and I don't think Silverlight's the future. But in terms of the UI, I certainly agree.
Yeah, that's all that I'm getting at, the UI and just web video in general, whether it's going to be a plug-in or a codec.
So
Chris, does it seem a little bit hot in here to you?
A little bit hot?
Yeah, I think we need to turn off the afterburners.
Oh, did we not turn off the afterburners?
We did not.
Oh, well, I did.
Well, then we've been spinning violently out of control, Chris.
See, maybe I liked the extra pace.
So Comcast is getting into the future with web video. We talked about when this first happened on the show, how they started a 250 gigabyte per month data cap for their customers. That's up and down. You can only hit 250 gigabytes per calendar month, but they are abandoning that policy and they are going back into the beta testing phase, and they're saying maybe 300 gigabytes a month, maybe we won't be so tricky about it, maybe we'll let people purchase more if they go over 300, and so they're not exactly sure where they're going now, but that 250 gigabytes a month cap, it's done.
I like that they're moving away from this in some ways, but in some other ways I think, well, come on, just get rid of the cap. Do they really need a cap? Is it effective at doing anything?
Well, you should be more worried about Verizon, and they are trying to kill off their unlimited data plans.
Yeah, and this one applies to me personally with Verizon and their unlimited data plans, because I'm one of the people who has one of the old unlimited data plans, and, you know, I really don't want to give it up. It was funny because there was a little blogger storm that said that Verizon was going to kill it and that people would not be able to have it. Turns out that's not actually true. You have to upgrade your contract to... They can't just invalidate your contract all of a sudden. You have to upgrade your contract to get that to change. So I'm still good. But what they were doing previously was they would grandfather you in. And even if you upgraded, you could keep your old contract even though you bought a subsidized phone. But they're trying to make it so that when you upgrade your phone on subsidy, they will kill the unlimited data plan. You will move to the tiered plans, or the shared plans, as they're calling them.
Well, but it seems like so far, according to their statement, the way you've been buying your phones, you'll be able to keep your plan. But you'll be stuck on their EVDO network.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's a little bit unclear to me if you buy an unlocked 4G LTE phone. Sorry, we've banned the usage of 4G, and I need to slap myself on the wrist.
I've retroactively self-banned the use of the word 3G.
So, the LTE, where was I? See, now I'm completely backwards. It's unclear from what they've said if you upgrade off-contract to LTE, but I'm guessing that they would lay the smackdown on you and force you to switch.
Yeah, it is a little bit unclear. You might be able to get away with it.
Yeah, I wonder. Because, you know, I used to have a plan where I didn't have a data plan and I would just use Wi-Fi everywhere. And at some point, they flipped a switch where if you bought a smartphone, you had to buy a data plan. Off contract. Even off contract. But I wonder if they'll pull the same kind of switch where they say, okay, if you upgrade to a phone, regardless of what it is, with a 4G radio in it, then you are forced into a certain contract.
Yeah, that's probably the way they will go eventually. But there's no language that says that they're going to go that way now.
Yeah, so for now, you're all right.
Right. You're all right. I'm already on a tiered AT&T data plan.
Right.
But I might be able to save some money soon with a tiered AT&T family data plan.
Yeah, and I wish we could just get unlimited plans. I would even pay more money for it at this point. I just don't want to have to worry about managing my data, and I don't think that there's any technical reason that I do need to manage my data.
Yeah, if they're okay with unlimited cell phone minutes and unlimited text messages, they really should offer an option for unlimited.
I mean, don't you data. Think, okay, well, right now I shouldn't say data is scarce, because data is not scarce. Bandwidth is scarce. So don't you think that once we move away from bandwidth being scarce, once we really fill up the spectrum and, you know, have the capability to where it's not even a question, like there is enough spectrum and we're good, our pipes are not clogged, that we will start to ratchet back toward unlimited data, kind of like the cell phone minutes?
No, I don't think so.
So it's just a business play in that case.
I mean, we may ratchet back towards cell phone minutes, but the thing is that you would never pay for unlimited texts or minutes. It's a total ripoff. I mean, would you pay $200 a month for unlimited data?
No.
Exactly. So I think we're never going to get back to the point where it's a reasonable amount. I think we're just going to get more ripped off.
Yeah, and like text messages are the ultimate consumer scam. You know, the text messages are these things that are engineered to go over a side channel and not take up any bandwidth whatsoever. It's just barely enough to eke out a little bit of data and then send that to somebody else. And we're getting charged by the message for it. It doesn't really make sense.
Nope, it does.
Or at least not from a technical perspective, but from a business perspective, it's gold.
It sure is. I really hope that somebody brings a full antitrust suit against them soon.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Remember, I think we talked a while back about the text messaging plans that conveniently got rolled out at the same time by almost all of the American carriers, except for, I think, maybe T-Mobile. I don't know. So we'll see.
T-Mobile. I know people who still use T-Mobile because they are still getting, they're grandfathered into the $5 a month unlimited texting.
Wow, that's not so bad. So I do understand at least charging for the service,
but that's,
right?
That's what it used to cost before people sent more than 100 texts a month.
Right. And now, how much is unlimited texting on AT&T?
$20 a month.
$20 a month? Well, I don't know. We'll see how it plays out, I suppose.
Well, we'll always see how it plays out, but hopefully we can affect some change. So how did bloatware on Windows play out?
Actually, for me, it plays out pretty well because I, you know, build my own computers and install Windows on them. Although I guess if you're getting a laptop, that's not really an option. But I always just reinstall Windows immediately so that I can kind of tune my own experience. But that's just because that's the kind of person I am. I'm sure you would do the same thing.
I did do the same thing.
Yeah, for
9 years ago, the last time I bought a Windows laptop.
Right. So I thought this was a little curious, and I thought maybe we could talk about it a little bit. But Walt Mossberg just published a review of Microsoft Signature PCs for some reason. And what's a little weird about that is that he, by the way, he likes them, as he should, as anyone should. It's Windows without all of the hardware manufacturers' bloatware on it. I mean, it makes sense. The Signature PCs are, in my opinion, much better for the end user. As long as they have the hardware that you want, at least. But Walt Mossberg published this review on May 15th of this year, a couple days ago. These things have been being sold since Windows 7 was released. So it's just, I'm not saying he's biased or anything, but why did he write this review? It's confusing to me.
You know what Walt Mossberg likes to say. He's Walt Mossberg. Shut up.
I think that was a puppet.
They both look the same to me. I can't tell.
And if some listeners don't know what you're talking about, there is a comedy series called Walt Moss Puppet. That's his tagline.
You should Google it and watch it.
Yeah, you should go watch some immediately. In fact, I'm going to go watch some Walt Moss Puppet after the show. What do you think? Awesome. If you were to buy a Windows PC, wouldn't you want a Signature PC?
Well, I don't know what it looks like now, and I don't think I would pay more money for that if I could just do it myself.
Well, yeah, you could do it yourself, and the computers that they have are about the same price, unless you are getting some kind of, like, deals thing.
Right. So, I don't know, though. I have a Mac, and they're all Signature.
Yeah, they're all kind of untouched, right?
Right.
Except for that, they've got that bloatware on them. iTunes, it's pretty bad bloatware.
No, iTunes is okay on OS X. It's just
I would
bad
remove that immediately if I were you.
There are some good options now. Maybe we'll talk about that in our tip of the week sometime soon.
Sometime soon. Okay, so next week's tip of the week, we'll have some options.
Okay. But yeah, I don't know. It's just Walt Mossberg doing his thing.
Yeah, I just think it's really odd, the timing of it. It's very odd. And he liked them anyway, so.
Right. Well, here's a fortuitous bit of timing. So last week, Chris, do you remember we talked about I had read a bunch of articles on how difficult it is to be an iOS developer, particularly the fact that 80% of developers in the App Store don't make any money.
Yeah.
Right. And there are some other things, and I talked about my personal experience with that as a not very successful iOS developer. Wannabe iOS developer. But this week we have a story on how difficult it is to be an Android developer. And it's an entirely different problem. And it has to do with when you're trying to develop for Android, you have all of these different devices that are accessing your app that you have to plan for. And one developer tried to map it out, and he figured out that there are about 4,000 unique devices that he had to anticipate when developing his app.
So, I mean, isn't this an old trick? Like, this is something developers have been doing for a very long time.
To show how difficult it is to be a developer.
No, I mean, you have to code to multiple platforms. I don't understand. This is not really a comment on fragmentation. It's just a comment on how many different kinds of Android phones there are.
Well, but if there were all these different kinds of Android phones, but they're all of them could be broken down into five easily grouped sets of devices for which you would have to program, then that would be a less fragmented ecosystem than the 4,000 unique devices that are currently available.
Sort of. I mean, that's just something you have to deal with.
Yeah, it's something that he has to deal with, and obviously it has not deterred this particular developer from being an Android developer, but don't you think that maybe there's a better way? There's a way to make his job easier?
Well, no, it's like saying that the web is fragmented because Internet Explorer has some oddities in it, and therefore it's really hard to develop for the web.
Well, it is really hard.
No, but I mean, it's just something you have to deal with as a developer. You know, there are multiple iPhones as well. I mean, there's not 4,000 of them, but how many iPhones have there been over the years?
I mean, the math gets kind of complicated when you look at whether you have the old display or the new display or the iPad or the new iPad or which operating system you have. I mean, it gets a little bit complicated, but it's still, you're probably dealing with like five variables and 10 devices as opposed to 4,000.
I mean, what about mobile websites? How many devices do they have to deal with? They manage to write useful things for the platform. I mean, they've got 4,000 phones and iOS and the pre and the kin. That's right. threw the kin in there. Why not?
Well, I just wanted to point out this concurrent story on the heels of last week to show that Android developers have a whole other problem.
Yeah, they've got all kinds of problems.
None of the situations that you're talking about come anywhere near these 4,000 devices that are just Android.
I mean, how many kinds of Windows PCs are there throughout Windows existence? I mean, people develop for that. I don't understand why having 4,000 different kinds of devices in the market necessarily means something bad.
All right. So Joe in our chat room pointed out that if you go into the Google Play market and you're looking for an app, sometimes it tells you that your device is not supported for this app. But that doesn't happen on Apple. That doesn't happen on Windows.
Well, no, it does happen. What if you have an iPhone 2G?
All right, well, then that's an obsolete device. But these are, you know, these are all current devices.
No, I doubt they're all current.
These 4,000 Android phones.
No, I doubt they're all current devices. This is the total landscape. This is an app that has a very large install base, and it's probably the sum total of the Android landscape.
Well, how many of those are obsolete Android phones? There's only a handful of them.
No, there are all kinds of people using obsolete technology out there. I mean, not everybody can stay current, or not everybody cares to stay current, no matter what we think about it.
I think you're making a straw man argument. I think this is a bigger deal than you think it is.
Well, no, I'm not saying it's not daunting for developers to tackle this kind of thing, but there are ways to do it.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, and there are ways to be an iOS developer, too. There's a way. There, obviously, people are successful at being developers, but this is just one particular problem that Android developers face, and it's a pretty significant problem.
Yeah, and then, well, in the end, if your app is simple enough, it's just Java. If you're coding something in the native development kit, the so-called NDK, that would get really, really hairy. But if you're writing a simpler app, like not a game or anything, then it's not so bad. It's just Java.
Well, I mean, I think for any developer, these problems only manifest themselves in the complicated apps.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
So there is a possible solution to make things a little bit easier.
This would make it worse.
What, the Nexus platform?
Yeah.
I think it makes it a little bit easier if you have a whole range of devices that are all Nexus branded and they're all guaranteed to work with anything. And so then if you're really worried about supporting 4,000 Android devices, you could just focus all your efforts on just supporting Nexus devices.
Sort of, yeah, you could do that, and that'd probably be the best way to do it. That's how they treated the Nexus One, if you remember, is the Nexus One was like, that was the thing that you developed to, you know, and if it worked on the Nexus One, you could kind of let the all the crappy phones go by the wayside that couldn't run your app. But if the Nexus One could run it for a long time, that was like the gold standard phone for Android. And they're expanding it here, which is interesting. And it's going to add more devices that you have to support as the gold standard. So now it's 4,000 plus 6 or whatever it's going to be.
It's definitely going to add to the fragmentation every time you add a new handset. But this gives a separate category that for people to develop to. And I think the line of Nexus phones at this point is too small to be considered a category. I mean, it's sort of just one phone and then another phone and then another phone. It's just one line. But if you make it into a whole premium line with a range of phones wide enough for anyone who's serious about working with an Android phone to have enough options to pick the one they want, then you are completely changing the landscape of the Android ecosystem.
Yeah, I could see that. And I think this is a good idea. And actually, you know what this reminds me of is Microsoft Signature PCs that we talked about earlier. Right? The Nexus is really a one-to-one match with Signature PCs.
I don't see it as one-to-one. I mean, I definitely see the analogy there, but I don't think it's one-to-one. I mean, this is definitely goes much deeper into the hardware and the user interface. You know, it's a much higher quality standard. It's a much higher standard of quality for the phone as opposed to just wiping out all the bloatware and making Windows work the way it's supposed to. That's not Microsoft's fault. I mean, PC manufacturers never got so atrocious at restructuring the operating system to their own ill-formed desires as Android phone manufacturers have done.
Well, no, I think you've got a bunch of OEMs and you've got a bunch of carriers fiddling with the software that they put on the phones. And if you buy a Google-blessed Nexus device, you're going to have options of multiple OEMs with pure Google software on it. I think it really is one-to-one.
I don't think it's one-to-one.
It's the same model.
I definitely understand what you're saying, but it's not one-to-one.
No, I mean, it's the same model, no?
Nope.
Well, what's different about it?
The level of integration that the OEMs are trying to achieve.
Yeah, so I mean, they can't skin Android in these Nexus devices.
Right. Were they skinning Windows PCs?
Yeah, they were.
Not like they are on Android.
Yeah, not like they are on Android. HTC Sense, for example, which happens to be one of the better skins, by the way, is really, it's a different beast. Okay, I see where you're coming from in that case.
The OEMs were never skinning Windows to the point where you couldn't install a software update.
Right, right. Yeah, I see where you're coming from in that case. It's pretty similar, though.
Yes, there's definitely a strong analogy.
But anyway, I do like this because I, just like I said about Signature, I like the pure Google software to be on the phone. I don't think the manufacturers have any business monkeying around with anything but driver integration and that kind of thing. And I don't think they have, even worse, I don't think they have any business in customizing like with Sense and TouchWiz UX. Yikes.
Well, with that, I completely agree.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's one manufacturer that really does a great job of getting rid of all the extra stuff and really simplifying the operating systems of all their devices. All roads end in Apple, Chris. All roads end in Apple.
Well, you know, when you're a hammer, all you see is nails. So the end of that one.
I'm familiar with the quotation. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm.
So anyway, speaking of Apple, I have this nail that I'm dealing with. And
wait, Apple's a hammer?
It comes in the form of this this power brick from one of the computers in my house. It's, you know, it's the MagSafe power brick from a MacBook Pro, and this one is broken. It's a spare, and I'm trying to figure out what to do about it. And
hey, you have to just throw stuff like that away. I've got a couple computers laying around, and it's like, well, what am I going to do with this thing?
Well, but I have so many options. One, I could take it apart and fix it. It would actually wouldn't be that hard with a soldering iron, which I don't have. But
yeah, you can borrow mine.
Another option would be I can cut the cord off and use the MagSafe adapter. Apparently, these are in high demand now because Apple won't let anyone else manufacture a MagSafe adapter. So, if you have a broken power brick with the MagSafe adapter, then you're in luck because you can just cut off that adapter and hook it into whatever other devices. And so there is a company called HyperMac that makes these external battery bricks and a conversion kit for you to be able to plug in their battery directly to your computer. Otherwise, you have to buy Apple's airline adapter that comes with a MagSafe.
Yeah, and I remember we talked about a story a while back about them cutting off third-party manufacturers at the knees in producing these MagSafe things.
Right, and so I didn't think at the time that that would apply to me, but now I have a computer with a lousy battery and a spare MagSafe connector, and I'm just trying to decide whether I should just fix up this power brick or chop off the head of it and connect it to an external battery. Now, the problem is that these Hyperjuice batteries would cost more than either buying a new power brick or a new battery. It actually costs more than both of them combined.
Yikes. Well, so what else can you do with that? That doesn't sound too great to me.
Well, the other thing I could do would be connect the MagSafe adapter to a regular universal power adapter, and then I would have a new power adapter that isn't broken.
Yeah, see, what I want to do is take it and then put a Arduino chip in it and go to town or something like that.
Mm. Well, actually, that is a third option, which I'm not considering, because you need not only a broken power adapter, but you also need a broken MacBook. But if you have both of those, then you can just go ahead and pull the MagSafe dock out of the MacBook, and then you have a MagSafe connector that you can use for anything. I mean, the whole point of the MagSafe to begin with, right, is that it's a breakaway power cable. So if you can pull the whole component out of the MacBook, then you can attach a breakaway cable to anything.
Yeah, that seems like a neat idea.
Yeah, but I don't have a broken MacBook to pilfer, so I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, and I feel like if you have a spare full computer, there's probably all kinds of stuff that you could do with it, like make a home server situation or something like that.
Yeah.
The home server situation. That's that's my next podcast, actually.
I think there are some podcasts about that.
No. That would be the title of my next podcast is The Home Server Situation.
Ah, that's pretty good. You'd have to pull a bunch of vowels and spaces out of there.
I'd have to make it Unix-y. There's a great book called Mommy, Why Is There a Server in the House?
Is there really?
There is.
I don't think that one is meant for kids or mommies.
No, it's meant to explain to kids why there is the server over there.
I see.
So I would call that the home server situation.
Well, I haven't decided what to do about this MagSafe conundrum of mine, but I'll have some updates in the future weeks.
Also, if you have suggestions for Taylor as to maybe what he can do with his spare power brick, send us an email at theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com.
That would be really awesome. I'm very easily influenced.
We need to find you a weekend project with that.
Well, I've got too many at this point. I just have to pick one, preferably the cheap one. But I got another weekend project for somebody with a lot more money than I do. We've talked, this is our Green Tech story of the week. We've talked a lot about solar panels on your houses. You remember a couple of weeks ago, Chris, I was talking about a new battery technology that if you have a bunch of solar panels, there's a new battery system for you to have to integrate a fully off-grid solar panel house. I mentioned at the time that doesn't apply to people who want to put solar panels on their house that's on the power grid. At that time, you needed to hire an electrician. You needed to set up a whole system with converters because solar panels generate electricity that's direct current, but then the power grid is alternating current. So you need to have a voltage regulator and you need a converter. But now you can buy a set of solar panels that does all of that for you. And here's the best part. All you have to do to set it up is put it on your roof and plug it into the wall.
Well, that's cool. So what, it feeds back the energy into the outlet? How does that work out?
Yeah, back into the outlet and back into your house and then back out into the grid. If your house was using no electricity and your solar panel was generating electricity, it would put that into the grid and your meter would spin backwards.
Nice.
And all you do is plug it in.
That's really simple. I feel like that's of a simplicity that has not happened thus far.
Yeah.
Of course, right. Thus why we're talking about it, right? Yeah, so that seems really cool. What's the company that makes these again?
They're called Spinray Energy. And right now they are selling them for $1,100 a kit, and you can hook up 5 of them at a time if you want to. And that'll generate you a megawatt of power.
You know, $1,100 isn't so bad. I mean, that's...
You get a lot of tax credits, too. I mean, that's attainable. It's all standard federal tax credits for setting up solar panels. And you save a bunch of money on installation because you don't have to hire an electrician.
So it's either TV or solar panels.
That'd be a nice TV.
Would be a nice TV. Well, no, what you have to do is go get that TV we talked about. I think that was last week. What was it, $9,000 for the...
Yeah, the Samsung OLED TV.
Yeah, the 50-inch OLED TV.
Yeah, that would definitely cost more than 5 of these panels. But the good news is you'd only need one of those panels to run that TV.
Right, sure. All right, well, thank you for the green tech, Mr. Marr. Let's move on to our tip of the week. As usual, you have a great one for us. I seem to never come up with tips of the week.
It's barely even a tip, really. It's the new Google Chrome, finally introduced into the stable release, tab syncing. All you have to do is sign into your Google account directly in Chrome, then it'll sync your open tabs across any of the devices that you're signed into.
Nice. Yeah, that's a pretty awesome feature. So if you have an Android phone and you use Chrome on the desktop and you have a Chromebook, which, by the way, because of the addition of the Chromebook, I just described absolutely no one. No, so there's some Chromebooks out there that people are using. But
yeah, they're definitely, and probably the majority of people who have Chromebooks also have a desktop PC and an Android phone.
Yeah, I could see that. But I mean, this is a dream. This is, you just open a tab, and just by the fact that you opened a tab in Chrome, when you leave your house, you can just pick right back up where you left off.
Yeah, it's great.
So, I mean, they had bookmark syncing. Well, it's not quite the same.
No, it's definitely not the same. I mean, you want to, some people want to have this full syncing. You just have everything open wherever you are. That's what the Chromebooks had already, and now it's built into Chrome everywhere you are. You're welcome. I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
But neither do you. All you do is sign in. That's it. Yep, barely even a tip.
Sign in and give your privacy away to Google, and
Well, but if you're using Chrome and you have a Google account, you've done that already.
Yeah, I use Chrome and AltaVista, so I don't have to deal with the Google privacy issue.
Oh, good for you.
No, I don't do that. Why would I do that?
AltaVista.
All right, well, let's keep on this kind of electronics kick we've got going. Your green tech was kind of electronics-y. What do you have for our last story of the day?
It's amazing that our kicker is actually more hacky than my green tech story.
Yeah, I love this. This is
but
great.
But they're both things that you can do in home. Okay, so a company called Makey has made their Makey invention kit, which it turns any object that conducts electricity into a touchpad. And then their built-in app lets you turn it into a keyboard or a mouse. So you can use their alligator clips just to connect it to anything that conducts electricity.
How about your skin?
Yeah, your skin would work fine, although, you know, you'd have to clip alligator clips to your skin.
Yeah, that would be a little painful.
A banana would work, a beach ball. You could even use soup, as they recommend in their advertisement. And so you can turn it into a keyboard or a mouse, just like that.
Yeah, this is really cool. This ties into what I was talking about earlier that you should do with your power brick with Arduino. You know, this seems like an Arduino-style hardware hacking kind of project, right?
Right. So this is a Kickstarter, actually, but they've already reached their funding, so you can be pretty sure that this is going to be a real purchasable product soon.
Yeah, once the Kickstarter ends, they get their money and they can actually develop the product. And before, they just had to have the idea and a proof of concept, right?
Right. I mean, well, they've already hit 4 times their goal, so they're going to get the money.
Yeah, so that seems... there are all kinds of creative things that you could do with this. Particularly, like, they have an example with Play-Doh in it. I could imagine all kinds of things that you could do with this.
Yeah, just anything that conducts some amount of electricity.
Yeah, and I would like to play Mario with putty. Seems like a good bit. Well, okay, how about the Mario portal with putty controls?
Sure, anything you want.
All right, well, that'll do it for this week. Taylor, how do we get you on Twitter?
Well, you can reach me at TaylorPhone.
And I'm at Chris Hale Barnes. So thank you everyone for listening to the show. And of course you can find more information at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. Just click on the tab in the upper right there. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. So have a look at Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. You can send us some feedback, like I mentioned earlier, at theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter. We are at @theenduser. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr. No wizards or mages were involved in the production of this podcast.
Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next week
with more wizardry.
Gremlins, on the other hand.
Bye-bye.